Hi, this is Jay Nemro. You're listening to Life Autistic. This is episode number 688. And in the last episode, I talked a little bit about how the economy is going. The fact that we're trying to borrow our way into less pain. How the government is reacting almost exactly like somebody who has a high limit credit card, and you know, people use their credit cards as a cushion. Now the government has a huge unlimited credit card, so it uses it as a huge, huge, huge cushion. And it's kind of make it so you don't have to feel any pain, don't have to have a lifestyle problem. Of course, we're finding out that in the past, where people used to use their credit cards very sparingly, and only when it was just desperately required. We find now that there's a lot of people who use that credit card all the time. You know, that it's just a regular part of business. It's like when you give a credit card to a teenager. And teenagers don't understand that these things have to be paid back. They don't really understand the concepts of interest and how interest kind of compounds on itself over time. It just depends on who's profiting off of that interest. You know, smart people have an excess put into interest-bearing instruments, and they profit off of compounding interest, the fact that all the money that gets made off of interest gets poured back into the investment, and then that interest just keeps getting bigger, you know. Every day the amount of money that gets added to it grows and grows and grows at a faster clip as time goes on, just from the simple reason that, you know, even if the interest rate remains steady, which it never does, you know, it's always fluctuating up and down. But when you're in that thing, even when the interest rate is really low, you know, people go, oh, you should invest in something else instead. And you go, well, you know, I mean, you can. The stock market is like gambling. But, you know, interest almost never goes to zero. It's rare that interest will go to zero. And, excuse me. And that means you'll always be making some money. It may be not very much, but it'll always be compound. It'll always be making more money, and the more money it makes, then the more money it's going to make next month, and then a little bit more next month, because that's just the nature of the beast. But when you're on the other side of that, when you have borrowed money and you aren't really stridently working to pay that debt off, if you're just sitting there and said, oh, I borrowed the money, I'm going to make the minimum payment and stuff like that, it's just going to keep eating and eating and eating, and the bite progressively gets larger and larger and larger until you're a slave to it. And so you don't want to be in those circumstances very much. You want to be on the other side of that. Well, the same thing is true with big, huge things. You know, the U.S. government is like a really big, huge, and frankly, it behaves in a fiscal standpoint like a teenager. It just spends money like a drunk monkey, You know, it doesn't give any thought to whether you're really going to have to pay any of this off. Nobody talks about that. Nobody does it. You know, everybody expects that you can just keep borrowing more money. You know, it's like going to a department store and saying, hey, I'll always shop at your department store. I'll always make it worth your while, but you need to loan me a lot of money so I can keep shopping at your store. And in a sick, twisted sort of way, that actually would make some sense to the store because, you know, stores profit off of volume. You know, if it looks like the store is really busy and there's really a lot of action going on there, for some reason, a whole lot of people, it isn't me and it certainly isn't Zenith people. I don't like big crowds. A lot of people think, oh, it's a happening, it's a cool place, and they will go there, and when you go there, the temptation is just to spend some money, you know. Window shopping is really not part of the American psyche, I suppose. My wife and I do it quite a bit. You know, whenever she goes, oh, Jay, let's just go do something, let's go window shopping. And that just means that you look in the window. You never actually buy anything. You take a look at stuff. You may buy a little thing here and a little thing there that you might need. But you don't do what that retailer is really wanting you to do. If he can get you to come to the store and look, you know, chances are they can get you to buy something. That's the whole point. That's why you have sales associates, or whatever they call those kind of people now, on the floor of places, you know, on your showroom floor. That's why in a clothing store you have, you try to get beautiful people that you want to please. You know, people who come up and give you strokes and make you feel good, and they tell you in sales school to learn people's names and to really give strokes to people who come in on a regular basis, because they know that the bottom line is that if you do that, they'll spend more. And that's the whole point of the store, right? The whole point of the store is to separate you from your money. Even if you don't have any money, they will help you separate money from people. Even if it's money that you've loaned to them. Because it does. It keeps things going. It means that if this person does get some money, you know, you're much more likely to get a piece of it. Which is what the world's all about. So I think that's what the United States on a very macro level is doing. You know, just kind of, you know, throwing money. They have an unlimited credit card because they can print more money. You know, they control how many dollars there are out there. And their biggest thing is, well, right now, they're printing up money as fast as they can. You know, they just gave people a big economic stimulus check. I think I spent most of mine just going up to visit my brother and bringing down some of his furniture. I would have saved a lot of money just having bought basically new furniture where I was and having him just kind of give his away. It would have profited us both better in a fiscal sense. But it was good that I took the opportunity to go up and be with him. I think that's useful. And I think it makes everybody feel good. And that's important. One doesn't want to put too much of a price tag on those things. Even though it might be a really smart idea to do it. But before I even started this little I hate to call them tangents anymore, because if they get big enough and long enough, and if I do the start and stop well, it doesn't sound like a tangent at all. You know, it sounds like, you know, a episode. You know? This world is full of tangents from probably what needs to be done into something else. But I've already told you what needs to be done. And, you know. And there isn't a whole lot to say about that stuff, except to keep repeating it over and over and over and over and over again. It makes me nuts. So I don't tend to be the kind of guy that gets a big kick out of doing it. What I was going to talk about was about the kinds of people that are our leaders. The sorts of things they do. And when I was thinking about it in the last episode, about, you know, about how much the way government spends and the kind of mindset they put toward government spending and the way that casinos think about spending. There are a lot of parallels that could be drawn. And And so I started to think, well, what about our, you know, government, civic leaders, whatever, and the kind of people that tend to run casinos. Now, I don't want to tell people that they're bad if they're not bad, or if I don't have any real evidence. I'm not going to name names because I don't know any names on this. But in the old days, in the past, I wouldn't be surprised if it was true now, it tended to be organized crime that used to run any kind of gambling. The fact now that a whole lot of gambling has fallen into the hands of government, I don't think means that it's been cleaned up or made pristine or all of a sudden nice people are in charge of it. I just think that organized crime has gotten itself a very cushy place now. Now they're on the government's payroll. You know, organized government doesn't, organized crime doesn't have to pay off government anymore to do things. They are now in government. You know, they have nice jobs. So I guess you don't see so much of organized crime, you know, offing people, although you still see it sometimes. People swear up and down that that the Clinton family, he was the president of the United States some years ago, that they had arranged to off certain people that they didn't like or that they felt threatened by or they felt like would expose the family as, you know, kind of cheap, greasy, punk criminals. When that started looking like it would apparently happen, you know, all of a sudden some people ended up, all of a sudden conveniently some people committed suicide. And of course everybody just kind of went, yeah, right, sure thing. It's more likely that they got off and it was passed off as a suicide. But I don't, you know, it was like I was telling my family this last weekend. You know, you have to be really careful. There are those who will spend a lot of time and energy trying to get rid of corruption. And the first thing you have to know is that those who get into a position of power where they can do something about corruption tend to get corrupted. You know, their days as an uncorrupted public official are pretty short. And because you have to. You have to work with a certain amount of corruption to keep things running. You find out that a lot of government has to do with coercion and fear, and when you start understanding those things, when you understand that you keep a lot of rules, or a lot of people keep a lot of rules, simply for fear of something bad happening to them if the government found out what they were doing. If you start to feel like, you know, that you're rubbing up against some kind of, you know, criminal syndicate. In the Book of Mormon, religious text, it talks about a group called the Gadianton Robbers. And anytime things really started to go kind of downhill, it was normally associated with either the reintroduction or expansion of this Gadianton Robbers outfit. And it really did explain the fact that there really is no great conspiracy going on. You know, people always tend to poo-poo things because, why is it flashing at me when I'm obviously way below the speed limit? That's weird. I think it's flashing because I'm not going fast enough. Anyway. I lost my train of thought. Darn it. I hate it when I do that. I get distracted by something and then I can't remember what I was talking about. I know I was talking about Gadianton Robbers. I know I was talking about, I was leading up to a point, and I've always got to be careful. When I'm leading up to a point, I tend to lose the actual point. All you got was kind of the beginnings of the leading. Oh, about conspiracies. You know, evil people love to say, oh, there's no conspiracy. And they're typically right. There really isn't a conspiracy going on because you don't have to have a conspiracy for a lot of evil. The only conspiracy going on is that evil people can recognize other evil people and they don't mess with each other. It's like two gangs will kind of divvy up a town. They will establish boundaries, you know. Our territory is here. This is our turf. That is your turf, you know. There's a boundary line between us. And we don't cross those boundary lines because doing so causes problems, you know. There's usually plenty of people to steal from. There's usually plenty of problems to cause. There's usually plenty of ways to make lots and lots of money. But, excuse me. You know, there's usually plenty of that to share. And what it is there's just kind of a, you know, it's usually a spoken agreement. It's usually not a written one, although that can happen, I guess, too. But yeah, it's just saying, you know, I'm not going to stomp all over his feet because I don't want him stomping all over mine when I'm doing my next, you know, sting thing. You know, when I'm bringing in my next shell, I don't want to mess with him bringing in his next shell. So we tend to kind of just make kind of a boundary between us so that we don't interfere with each other's business. And that's not really a conspiracy. That's just kind of an almost gentleman's agreement, although these people aren't particularly gentlemen. And that's okay, you know, who cares? So you can see it that tons and tons of evil can still happen. And it isn't that they're in collusion with each other. They're just, you know, putting up some boundaries so that certain people don't mess with certain other people. You'll find this happening all the time. It's one of the things that comes out in the Book of Mormon. And if you look around you at the evil around you, you see that it's done the same way. Even in my town, where I think the evil in my town is somewhat kind of lame, but you still don't want to mess with it because even lame people have guns, and even lame people can feel threatened and choose to retaliate against you. And that's really what you don't really want. This is, you know, I'm kind of a guy that says, let evil be. Let evil do what evil does. Try to stay away from it. Know that to some degree they're going to own businesses or have controlling interest in companies that you don't have any choice but to deal with. Therefore, evil is going to profit off of you, but don't get weird about it. Evil has just as much incentive as everybody else does of only fleecing you a bit. You know, because if they fleece you any more, they might draw some scrutiny from government, which is also kind of in this whole game of, you know, we set up boundaries, you know, as long as you don't go traipsing into territory that we feel like we have to get involved with, we'll pretty much leave you alone. You know, that's why small-time crime is normally just ignored, is because, number one, it's small-time, it doesn't affect a lot of people, and number two, you know, it's really not worth the effort going after. I mean, it's sad when something bad happens to you. It's like somebody who gets their purse stolen in New York City. You know, if you call the cops to say, I got my purse stolen, I want you guys to investigate and try and find it, they're going to laugh at you. And you go, well, aren't you guys concerned with justice? And you go, in this case, not really. You know, it's your own personal responsibility to handle your personal effects. Police aren't going to do anything about it unless they just happen to be on the scene when it happens. If he just happens to be there and he happens to see some perch snatcher going off, hey, you know, it's probably in his best interest to go after that person. If just for the PR of it, you know, people will stop supporting police officers if they start figuring that they aren't doing anything. They need to be doing something, although they may not be doing anything for you. You know, they run kind of a business too. You know, a lot of government is in the business of PR. You know, public relations. If you can keep people thinking that you're worthwhile to have around, then, you know, nobody really gets, you know, there's a whole bunch of people that say, I think they basically do good stuff, so we're not willing to chop it off at the knees. And then you'll have a certain amount of people that say, oh, I depend upon this, you know, if you're giving, like, welfare checks out, as long as you don't treat people too badly, as long as you don't have too many rules on them, most people think that it's basically a good thing. Like right now, you know, a lot of people poo-poo welfare and say that we spend too much money on it, but nobody's actually saying that we should do anything about it particularly. We tried that once about 10, 12 years ago, and, you know, tried to make a lot of changes, tried to end poverty, or end welfare, as we know it, and it was somewhat of an interesting thing. People just found new ways to work that system, and you know, it was, there's nothing else to it. That was just how it kind of went. And, you know, did things really get resolved? Well, no. You know, poor people were still getting checks. You know, and those guys said, oh, you only have 5 years. Once you use those 5 years, you don't get any more money. And then all of a sudden the 5 years came, and quietly the laws got changed so that, you know, you got something. Always. You know, because you just don't do that to people. Nobody wants to see... Even the evil people don't want to see people wandering around on the streets. Looks bad, you know. And it creates a whole other problem that needs to be dealt with. And, you know, people kind of like the way it is right now. So, all that stuff that happened 10 years ago about welfare reform, for instance, it's pretty much just been slowly, quietly, rescinded. It just didn't happen. Nobody really got off of welfare. Although the threat of it happening got a lot of people into job training, and some of them maybe got themselves out of poverty. So chances are, here at some point in the future, they'll threaten to do it again. You know, they'll scare a lot more people. But you have to be careful. You have to let some time pass so that new people come in. Because, you know, I remember when I was working in kind of a contract agency, quasi-government, whatever, and I kind of hit the tail end of that stuff, or at least 3 or 4 years in. There's a lot of people that have taken advantage of programs to help them become more self-sufficient. And I came in kind of toward the tail end of that. A lot of people who had that capability but were just sitting on their haunches because, you know, they were getting paid and going out and doing something pays about the same as getting the benefits. Those people have gotten off their haunches. Those people have gone out and tried to find jobs, got daycare, you know, whatever things they needed. And the people that I were left with trying to help were what were called the chronic welfare recipients. People that didn't have either, number one, didn't have the capability of supporting themselves at all, or ones that were much more strident about they were going to find ways without having to go to work for somebody or get self-employed or something like that. You know, you had those people. And, and so I was dealing with those folks, and those folks are just intransigent. You know, they make promises, they keep maybe 1% of the promises they make, or they don't even try at all. And that's kind of how that system deals with it. So in these coming up years, before we try to do another big welfare reform push, you have to get new people in, kind of new... nouveau lazy, you know, people who probably could go out and work, probably do have the abilities and the capability. You need a new generation of those people who are on welfare, so that when you do the next welfare reform, it looks good. You know, it makes the politicians look good. Look at our wonderful numbers. This is how many less people there are in the welfare rolls now than there were, you know, last year. you know. And it has nothing to do with making people's lives better. It has to do with making politicians and leaders look good. It's feathers to put in a cap. It's somewhat manufactured. Right now we're going through a phase where, and I've seen, you know, people who have a few really interesting kind of, I call them dingbat morals, you know. And I don't want to put titles to it, but, you know, people who say, oh, well, I don't want people going out and getting food stamps. I worked for a quasi-federal agency, Cooperative Extension Service, is one of my clients. And they put up posters, you know, that say, that encourage people to go and get food stamps, you know, for the extensive reason that we don't want people just starving. You know, that was the reason that it was put into place. Of course, these people are, you know, people who are for Cooperative Extension Service are rugged individualist types. And they say, oh, they're good, everybody should be doing that. We shouldn't be encouraging people to go out and get food stamps. By golly, you know, they have the idea that everybody that takes food stamps is a lazy bum. And that if we just got rid of food stamps, that would solve a ton of problems. Of course, you know, it probably wouldn't. This also comes from the same mindset that says that you know, everybody can take care of themselves. I did. And you're going, well, you have some capability that other people might not have. You need to be kind to the poor. I always, I'm going to jump on it. I don't want to chew on Christians, but Christians are among the worst at this, at least mainline Christians are, about, you know, because Christianity is supposed to be charitable, supposed to be full of nice people that are giving and kind and trying to take care of each other. And a lot of Christians I know aren't that way, you know. They tend to be mostly, you know, you need to kick people in the butt and stuff like that. And that all of a sudden becomes some kind of godly charity, is to kick people in the butt and tell them to get busy. When you're going, you know, I do know people who have absolutely no capability, you know. And people always come up with the whole excuse of, well, you know, it was their own fault, you know. They got the drugs, they got stuff like that, they screwed up their brains, and now we can't really help them, you know, or now you shouldn't help them because they're just a huge drag. I find it interesting that when people come to the town, through my town, which is kind of a transient town, and they usually call our church, because our church has a reputation for helping out people that have trouble, being kind of somewhat kind-hearted. And I find it interesting because we always used to tell them, well, go call your church. What religion are you? Or what denomination are you? Almost everybody's Christian. What denomination are you? And they'll say, oh, I was raised a Baptist. And you go, fine, then go call the Baptist church. And the first thing, you know, and they just say that right now, oh, we don't do that. We don't do a benevolent fund. We don't believe in that. And it's like, wow, are you sure you're Christians? That's supposed to be one of the hallmarks of being Christian, is to be giving and helping people in need and stuff like that. Whatever happened to the whole parable of the Good Samaritan, when what you see more and more is when it walks by you as a church, that you're just willing to walk down the other side of the road and act like those people aren't there. You see that so much among the Christian denominations that, you know, when people decide they want to be an atheist, when people want to decide that Christianity is a bunch of bunk, I don't give them a lot of garbage for it. And it's mostly because I think a lot of the mindset that many quote-unquote Christians use, put out there, is. It's totally hypocritical. And I'm not saying that I'm sweet and pure as the new driven snow. I'm not. I struggle with these things too. I struggle with helping people, knowing how to help people best. I'm trying to work on the basic outfit that you need to help everybody that you come in contact with. Me personally, I can't just give people money because I don't have any real spare money. All my money is somewhat chewed up with just trying to keep things going for a family of eight. And of course, I get chastised rather highly for having a family of eight. How dare I, if I had a family of, you know, three out here, you know, I could help so many more poor people. And I said, isn't it better that I've given life to six more people and they don't have to suffer the way other people do? Of course, people don't think that. People think that you know, kids just drop out of trees or something. You know, that the best thing we can do is stop having children. But that's mostly a selfish act. To say that, well, I'm sorry, that comes into a lot of things. And I got on the whole Christian jag, and I need to get off of it, because I don't like picking on Christians particularly. You know, people have their problems. I think Christians are very good at having blinders on and saying, you know, everything's wonderful, everything's beautiful, we're all taking care of each other, yada, 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 when it's no such thing. You're not taking care of each other at all. Says you just choose to surround yourself by people who aren't needy, who don't need stuff. My biggest issue is with people who have such chronic needs. You know, I think it's funny that when a bunch of poor people put up a tent city, which I personally think is an act of taking control of your life and being a little bit responsible by saying, you know, I can't afford the kind of housing that's legal, you know, stick built, costs $100,000 to buy it, yada, 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 that kind of stuff. They'll put up a tent city. And, of course, the authorities of your town or your county or your state or whatever come in and take that thing down and evict everybody and say, you can't do that. And you're going, well, then what are they going to do? Oh, well, we have public housing for people like that. And you go, oh, so it's very, very important that these people become dependent on government. It's very, very important. Because once they try to step out and say, I'm taking control of my own life, we slap them down. So yeah, when people talk about trying to teach these people responsibility and trying to teach these people self-reliance, I laugh. I laugh at them. And they go, you have no such interest. Really. I said, I know very few people that when it really gets down to it, really believe any of that. I mean, they'll spout it with Christian zeal, but you can take them apart in 5 seconds. You go, you don't believe any of that, and I'll tell you how. If somebody, you know, you could be kind by letting people put up their tent in your front yard so that they can have some dignity. You can let them borrow your shower so that they can clean themselves, you know, live in a tent and go out and get a job so they can feel a little bit more independent. You could do that, and they go, oh, no, 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 no. Those smelly, slimy people like that, they must go to government programs. And that's how those things get taken care of. And you go, oh, well, then you really don't care. You don't really care about these people really getting a, you know, getting any kind of respect, do you? You really don't care. Well, as long as it's not costing me anything, as long as I don't look bad to my neighbors, you know, it took me a long time to build up to the place I have, this beautiful house, and I'm not going to have some vagrants, they just revealed themselves, some vagrants camping out on my front lawn. That's just no. And you go, okay. You go, okay. You know, I said, I don't want to hear you complain ever again about the smelly, distasteful things that poor people choose to do. Because you aren't going to give them any other opportunity but to be smelly, disgusting, and distasteful. By your actions, you're indicating that that's what you want those people to do. That's how you want those people to look. You know, I shop at thrift stores. My wife shops at thrift stores to get clothes for our kids, to get housewares when we need them. That's what we do. Not always, but often enough that you do that. I'm always amazed by otherwise seemingly, and I say seemingly with big, broad letters, seemingly Christian people, who the first thing they do is they turn up their noses at such things. I don't go to those kinds of places. Those kinds of places are for greasy, slimy vagrants. And you go, I see. I bet you find some low-life person, you know, the lowest person in your socioeconomic class, you throw your old clothes at them, knowing that they will, you know, frankly, I get more clothes thrown at me. Wow, I get a ton of clothes thrown at me. I am technically not supposed to be able to podcast because I really don't have the resources to do it. That's how you can keep up a pristine, clean, beautiful, wonderful kind of fantasy world, is that, you know, the slimy, grody, underbelly type people don't have the capability, don't have the smarts. Well, I have the smarts. So I do it. I do it in ways that other people say, oh, you can't do that. That can't be done. How on earth can you afford the bandwidth to do that or the server space? I go, well, I provide my own server, and I keep my recordings really, really tiny so that they're easy to download, and I throttle it way back so it doesn't affect my bandwidth. And I've got a really cheap server plan. And not a server. A really cheap internet plan that allows me to serve things over the web, which are really getting hard to find anymore because they just don't make those. You know, you're supposed to be a consumer, not a producer. Rich people produce things. That's how they stay rich. Everybody else just consumes things. And rich people consume them, too. You know. Anyway, so the fact that I'm able to do this is because I'm smart and I'm a little bit resourceful. I don't have a lot of resources. Most people, when they hear what my family size is and how much money I make, how can you possibly make it? And you go, I've made it on a lot less over time. Because I'm being very blessed right now that I'm still able to keep up this stuff. I've gotten, my job does quite well. Anyway. You know, richer people are people that wish they were richer than I were, or are doing better, or want to give the impression that they're doing better than I am. will often throw their children's hand-me-down clothes at me, at my family, sorry, not just me. And that's okay. It doesn't bother me particularly. Except that we always have mounds and mounds and mounds and mounds and mounds and mounds and mounds of clothes. I rarely have to go out and buy clothes because so many clothes get thrown at me. The only reason why I have to buy some clothes is because my kids are of a weird size. I have skinny kids, and it's not from lack of food. Lisa does a wonderful job, given our resources, in providing really good food for us. It's amazing. We end up trying to give things to places like Goodwill, for LDS people, Deseret Industries, Salvation Army. In our town, it's run by some nice Catholic people. It's called St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store. Stuff like that. We tend to give it to them because we don't have an issue with doing that. You know, it doesn't bother us. The people that go to thrift stores in my town look a whole lot like me. I don't often get there because it's not open when I'm around. I'm off, you know, traveling, working, making a living. You know, my wife ends up having to do those things because that's her job. She doesn't work outside the home particularly. Her job is to take what I can provide and turn it into the things that we need. I think the much more vital job, and the job that I think means the most to everybody, is that one right there. So I think it's kind of interesting, you know, people who think so highly of themselves and how wonderful they are and how they are so Christian, and yet, you know, they don't want to get their fingers dirty. They don't want to do this. They really don't want to do that. Now, I'm not saying all of them are. Certainly not. There are some wonderful people out there that happen to be Christians. I think it's kind of a misnomer to say, well, this is how Christians behave, because I'm sorry, I see many professed Christians that don't behave that way. I'd rather give the people that do behave that way some other title, like a generous person. You can, you know, if you want to shove the title Christian on there still, that's cool. You can do that. I'd call them a generous Christian as opposed to a showy Christian, you know, that says, oh, I'm so saved, look at my beautiful clothes. You know, the Book of Mormon has some interesting insight into that. Very interesting. It even goes so far as to talk about the fact that, you know, even if you say, you can say in your own heart, these people deserve what they get, you know. These welfare recipients have destroyed their lives with drugs and fast living and stupidity. And they deserve what they get. And the Book of Mormon strongly says no. It says if somebody's giving out, has their hand out wanting help, you help them. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily that you're going to be able to give them money. Although, if you have some spare money, you probably should give it. You know, people always say, oh, no, they're just going to go out and buy drugs and alcohol with it. And you go, fine. Then you need to dig down a little deeper and say, what do these people really need? Don't just take what they say at face value. Well, I need some money. And then they start giving you the reasons why they need money. And that's what you should really be doing. You know, they say, well, I'm hungry, I need some food. So I need some money to get some food. And you go, well, let me just go get you some food, and I'll bring it to you. And they say, okay. I've never had it turned down. Because those guys know that eventually they will get money. I've always noticed it. You know, people will cause traffic jams trying to give somebody who needs some help, some money. Stuff like that. you know, when those guys say, need money, don't have job, and somebody comes up and offers them a job, now that one's tougher because that one has kind of a long-term commitment that some people really weren't doing. That's why a whole bunch of people, that's why smarter panhandlers don't do that. You know, they tend to play up the fact that they can't get work, you know. They tend to play up the idea of being disabled or, you know, something like that, so that they can just get money without any strings attached. And I'm not saying that some people don't do that or do that. You know, I don't know people's individual circumstances. It might be useful to find out, to help them, with an eye to helping them, not with an eye to saying, I'm going to find something here that makes me say, I'm not going to help these people. That's why, you know, you tend to stop by stores and you give people cans of something. When those guys say, I'm hungry, and you go, oh, well then here's some food I have with me. You can have that. I don't need it. And they'll get to eat. You go, because that's what a lot of those people are looking for. They're not really going anywhere, you know. Some say that they need a ride somewhere, and you ask them, well, where do you need a ride to? Oh, I'm trying to get to this place. It's usually a place not too far away, but you could probably take them. On the interstate, it's usually the next big town, you know. In my town, it's either I want to get to Albuquerque or I want to get to Amarillo. And you go, is that really your destination? Or are you hoping to get somewhere else? And they said, yeah, I'm really kind of hoping to get somewhere else. And when you ask them where are they headed, they really don't know. They're really kind of attaching dreams to it. You know, well, I've got an uncle, a great uncle in Chicago. And I'm hoping they can help me out. And you go, you know, I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know if that's just simply another front being thrown up to make you feel bad, to give them what they need, you know. And it's just because of that kind of lack of that whole Christian, quote-unquote Christian ethic, that says, hey, if somebody's got their hand out, you help them. You know, people can be a lot more straightforward if they think that if they tell you a straightforward story, they're going to just get some help because people are just helpful. We've gotten into the thing where people have to lie to us on a pretty habitual basis in order to get what they want. I find that if you can really just get down to, you know, what are you really after? Because I'd be willing to help you with what you're really after. I'm not really interested in helping you particularly with just surviving another 5 minutes. What do you really want to do? And not to keep you here, you know. Well, have you talked to your great uncle? Oh, no, I don't think I could do that. No. And you go, well, then once you get to the blessed land of Chicago, thinking that all of a sudden great things will happen if you're there with your great uncle, why don't we just find out if your great uncle is really willing to help? Or if they really have anything. For all you know, this is, well, I'm kind of hoping he has a business. I'm kind of hoping he'll give me a job. And when you call that great uncle, he'll go, you know, I wouldn't hire that guy for a second. And then you can start operating off the whole thing of, this guy just wants to have a job. Or are you just saying that in order to get yourself in a better position? You know, what exactly are you after here? That's kind of what it comes down to. I keep smelling like something's on fire. I see a haze, but it doesn't look like a kind of burning pays fire. I'm worried that it's me, but it doesn't smell like burning oil. It smells like burning wood or rubber or something. I could be contributing to burning rubber. I may have to pull over soon just to kind of see what's going on. Although there is kind of a haze, it could be a fire. Oh, I don't know. Anyway, so. And I'm not saying that's the best either, because people continue to keep putting up, and many people do, you know, continue putting up things that they think are more likely to get them toward a goal that they really don't have clearly in mind. You know, they want to get to some promised land. You know, that promised land, a lot of people interpret that as the American dream, and they may or may not want to get a house someday, but they're going to tell you they want to have a house because it's more likely to get something out of you. It may just be surviving from day to day. And these guys know that if you stay someplace too long, you know, you'll have to take on some serious responsibilities. You know, you're going to have to try to hold down a job. You're going to have to have a real live place to stay and stuff like that. And these are some pretty hefty challenges. It pains me that our society demands these things, and you know, it's more than some people are willing to put toward, and I don't particularly blame the people who say, I don't want that. I've often thought that life would be a little bit better if I separated myself a little bit from the American dream. I can't do that because there's actually two basic reasons why I can't do that. Number one is that my wife wouldn't tolerate anything besides pretty much some variation on exactly what we're doing right now. Now, I think she would like me to make a lot more money. Now, she isn't going to go so far as to tell me, Jay, you just need to make a lot more money because I'm unhappy with my circumstances. But, you know, that involves having a nice house. That involves having a nice car. She wants to be as middle class as she can. Her parents, ultimately, I think when she left home, they were scratching it middle class. Her father was making good money. They still lived in kind of a little, you know, little inexpensive part of town. Basically the house they had bought when, you know, right off of World War II, right after the GI, you know, as part of the GI Bill, this was part of what they got, was this kind of a little house. And they stuck with it. And ultimately, very nicely appointed on the inside. You know, nicely done. But, and I think she still wanted to do that, you know. I don't want to say bad things about my wife. I have long since lost any of the appeal for that because of how much garbage goes with it. But my wife doesn't, you know. My wife works very hard. I don't want to denigrate her wishes at all. Except to say, I think it's mostly kind of pandering to society, pandering to culture. And not really seeing to, it's not a question of seeing to anything. That's what it ultimately is. This is what you do. This is how you have success. Success brings on good things. That's one of the people that these things happen in our family for them. The other one is, I know that if I don't keep up a certain amount of doing what society wants you to do, my children will be taken away by the authorities. And I know that sounds paranoid, but that's because I'm a Zenith, Asperger-ish type person. And we tend to be obsessive-compulsive and And I think I'm even more paranoid schizophrenic. But I think that's also because society likes to pin people with paranoid schizophrenic, because that gives them the justification for, if you choose to start living in a tent, you know, there might be a little bit of accommodation, but not much. If you're really in poverty, or if you're a flood victim or something, anytime that, you know, after about 5 months of being a flood victim, you better the heck be out of that tent, you know, because this tent city's coming down. That's only for emergency problems. You're not supposed to get comfortable in there. You know, you're expected to get into a house. You're expected to look decent. You're expected to dress a certain way and be a certain way. And there it is, you know. That's what's expected of you. And if you don't rise to those expectations, well, the first thing they do is they take your kids away. Or they threaten to, because they know that'll give a lot of people a lot of incentive to fall into line. You know, you're going to be dressing better, you're going to go out, you're going to work really, really hard, 2 or 3 jobs. I always found it interesting that the President of the United States, George Bush, George W. Bush, probably in about 2003 or 2004, about the time he was running for re-election again, it must have been in 2003, he was in a town hall meeting. You find these things all very interesting, because they're kind of a setup. You know, you go out among the normal people, you know, among regular people, and they could, you know, and they, I swear they love to tell these people, make sure you dress up like a hunter or a flood victim. You know, this is what real America is. Guys who go out and shoot things for food, and, you know, women who are single and doing stuff like that. Anyway, he was sitting next to and kind of talking to, with a microphone in his hand, a single mom, and she was talking about how hard it all is, and she's talking about the 3 jobs that she has to try to feed her family and try to keep up with all the things that Americans are supposed to have. And, of course, President Bush said, oh, isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful? You know, America's working for her, and you're going, and she was giving him this look like, are you nuts? I would just as soon have 1 job. And I said, you know what? If that woman were allowed to, you know, live in a tent, for instance, or allowed to, ride back and forth to work on a bicycle instead of having to have a car, if all these things were allowed, she probably wouldn't need 3 jobs. She might be able to cut down to 2, or maybe even 1. If she got some education, some experience, she may only need a part-time job. That's what I've always been kind of hoping to have someday. Get myself into a position, although I don't know how I'm going to do it right now, because society really doesn't like part-time work. It looks really down on part-time work, and it provides certain disincentives for part-time work, you know. The biggest one is medical care, you know. We've made medical care so vastly expensive for everybody that, you know, if you don't have your employer paying for a chunk of your health insurance, and you still shell out quite a bit for the other part, you know, you won't have health insurance. You'll be in trouble. Of course, you know, we have Medicaid and stuff like that. But that's mostly for children. That takes care of your kids, which is sweet. But you know what? You have to keep yourself well to keep doing a job. I always found that kind of funny. I thought the two sorts of people that did best in our world, the only two that were really looked upon with any kind of grace at all, were very poor people who get tons and tons of benefits. I mean, you put them through a meat grinder to do it, that's part of the fun of being, you know, of being kind of an upper crusty or a middle classy person, is that you get to have the fun and joy and, oh, this is so much fun, of watching poor people do your bidding, you know. That's pretty heady stuff. You know, it kind of comes from the days of, you know, Romans would throw people into the lions and get a lot of entertainment out of watching lions rip poor people apart. I kind of look at it as kind of a variation of that kind of mentality. You know, I like watching people squirm. I like having control over people's lives. I like being able to hire them and fire them. I like the chance I can put the squeeze on them and watch them just do my bidding and basically get down on the floor and kiss my feet, or else I'll throw them to the lions. You know, woohoo, this is fun. So, there's those poor people, and then there's those that I guess get called the rich. I don't know what constitutes rich anymore. I don't know what ever did. Anyway, but, you know, people who get to enjoy that kind of stuff. I kind of fall in the middle, and frankly, being in the middle is, frankly, among the worst circumstances, you know? Just when you think you're doing okay and you can take care of yourself, all of a sudden you can't because of circumstances. You know, I have cars, but they're thrasher cars, and one of my biggest fears is getting rid of my thrasher car before it starts having huge problems. You know, I was just dealing this week, well, I'll talk about stuff like that later, about the curse of having stuff and the cost of having stuff. Anyway, so there's Jay Nemro. Organized crime isn't fought by government. It is government. You know, it is government. Just depends on how corrupt you are. It isn't a question of, are you corrupt? Yeah, right. It's a question of, who's got you bought and paid for, and do I have any problem with the person, with the organization, the corporation, or whatever that owns you? If I don't have a big problem with that organization, hey, I don't care if they're running the world. It's all about who's bought for, who's bought, and who's paid for, and how many of them are in Congress at any given time. Anyway, this is Jay Nemro. This is episode number 688, and listening to Life Autistic, have a great day.